Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. So yesterday, Mark gave an introduction to the Noether's first theorem in the context of particle mechanics, so finite dimensional systems. Today, he will move on to speak about field theory. And so without further ado, please, Mark.
Thanks. Thanks, Aldo, and welcome back. And so today, let's move on to field theory, and let's jump right in and start with, again, the first theorem. So essentially the same thing as yesterday. We consider a Lagrangian that depends on now a field, and let's say first derivatives of the field. And now we can write the variation of the Lagrangian, doing the same manipulation as yesterday, integrating by parts to isolate the equation of motion. And we get dl by d phi minus d mu dl d mu phi. Here we have delta phi. And now the boundary term is the divergence of this quantity theta. By the way, yesterday, I'm not sure if we gave a name to this. This is called the pre-symplectic potential. We call it pre-symplectic and not just symplectic because especially later on in gauge theories, we will have to worry about the gauge directions in this object. And this theta, of course, is here, theta is dl by d mu phi, delta phi, and that's the momentum to phi, as usual. And of course, this is just the example of a first-order Lagrangian. If you had to deal with a second-order Lagrangian, you do the same manipulation on the second-order derivatives. So you would have an extra term here with a plus sign and d mu d nu and the corresponding term here. So there's no problem in adapting this to higher-order theory and then performing this integration by parts. This theta would change, of course. Whatever you integrate by parts to isolate this will appear in this symplectic potential theta. So now for a symmetry, now if we have a symmetry, so by definition, this means there is some transformation. So now we're still concerned only with the global symmetries. So epsilon does not depend on space-time. This is acting on L, and this has to give us a boundary term. Now the boundary term has these four indices. And let's call it B epsilon, like yesterday. Okay. And now this tells us immediately, if we have this, we can plug this variation delta epsilon in this formula here. This is also yesterday what we called E delta phi, the equation of motion plus d mu theta mu. So we get immediately a conservation law, g mu epsilon, this is minus E delta phi, so this is vanishing on shell. If we just identify this quantity here, so this current, which is now the Noether current of this symmetry for this field theory, where this j mu epsilon, by definition, so it's the same structure as yesterday, except that we have these space-time indices now. This is theta mu evaluated on delta epsilon. So again, in theta now, this delta is delta epsilon. It's the symmetry variation. So this is what I denote by theta mu delta epsilon minus this boundary contribution. OK? So this is the conserved Noether current. Now the question is how to get a conserved charge from this conserved current. And the way to do this is, let me just make a remark first. The remark is that you can see from this formula that actually identifying this conserved current here, J, is actually ambiguous now. In mechanics, this was not ambiguous. But now there is an ambiguity because we notice that if you have such a conserved current, J, so the ambiguity is that if you shift J by J plus the derivative of something which is completely anti-symmetric, let's call this thing A, plus maybe a K, if K is vanishing on shell. Now this new current also satisfies this conservation equation. So there are two ambiguities. This one is a bit trivial because this itself vanishes on shell, and this one is an ambiguity due to an anti-symmetric tensor here. And this ambiguity will be important later on, and in particular when we look at gauge transformations. Okay. So now from this, we can build a conserved charge. This conserved charge, like yesterday, let's call it Q epsilon. And this is just the integral over some spatial hypersurface sigma of the time component of the current. So the reason for which this is conserved, for the moment it's not really manifest or guaranteed, but the reason is that you see we took the time component of this current here, which is conserved. So if we compute the time derivative of this charge now, okay, dt epsilon, we can use now this conservation equation, the fact that this is zero on shell, to write that dt of j0 is minus dA of jA, where A are the spatial indices. So this is minus d3x jA. Now using Stokes' theorem, this reduces to a boundary integral. So I denote this with this, so just visually with this circle so that we can really see, this will be important later on, the distinction between kind of usual volume integrals and surface integrals. So this is the boundary of sigma. Now d2x. Now I need the normal to the boundary to contract this free index. So we get this. So this means that if there is no boundary, or if the boundary conditions are such that either the fields die off at infinity on this boundary, or the gauge parameter dies off, this will be zero, and you will get a conserved quantity. So let's just write that this is zero for appropriate boundary conditions. And again, properly discussing this, the nature of these boundary conditions will be very important in gauge theories. But that's just the basic structure we get already at this stage. Now, one important thing we can do in field theory, so again, this was just simple application of the first theorem, kind of the same structure as in mechanics, except that now there is this ambiguity which appears, and to build the conserved charge, we have to take the time component of the conserved current. Now we could do very useful things with this in field theory, but one particularly useful thing for the rest of the discussion is to discuss the energy momentum tensor. So the conserved energy momentum tensor. Because this is a particular quantity which you can build actually using a symmetry principle. So using the first theorem and actually applying the first theorem to space-time translations. And if you apply the theorem to space-time translations, because there are four space-time translations, one in time, three in space, you get actually four conserved quantities. And because of this, the current that you build actually involves a tensor. So let's just write that from invariance under this symmetry minus epsilon mu, we can build conserved quantity J, which necessarily has this form. Epsilon nu. In the notes, for convenience, I had a minus sign here. That's just to be consistent with all the definitions which appear later on. So let's just immediately compute an example of this. In the notes, you will see there is the example of the scalar field. You can actually do this, really use this symmetry transformation, apply this to the Lagrangian of a scalar field, and you will find here, when you compute the current, you will see that it has this structure. You identify this tensor. This tensor is conserved on shell of the equations of motion. And that's the energy momentum tensor of a free scalar field. There is also a mass term here. You can put a mass term, of course. What is important, yes?
Usually, like even yesterday when I asked, when we define a symmetry by saying our delta L is d mu, means this complete divergence, and if we don't impose any restriction on what b mu can be, means can it depend on the derivatives, then we get the variational principle to not be well defined, right? Something like this happens in the Hawking York term or something like that, where you have derivatives in your boundary term, then the variation is not well defined. Mm-hmm. But even yesterday in mechanics and even here, we didn't put any restriction on what b mu can be. So how does that fit? Because I don't think it will be a symmetry if that problem occurs, right?
Yes, so good question. So there are two issues, in fact. One issue is, of course, defining properly the variational principle, so taking care of the boundary conditions such that we have a well-defined variational principle. This is something which we will discuss a bit later on if we have time in general relativity. And now the question is also how this interferes with the definition of symmetries. Yeah. And in fact, the answer is that it doesn't. Because you saw, in fact, from what we did yesterday and from what we're doing now, we're not doing really anything illegal here. In fact, from what we did yesterday, there is, in the proof that we gave, at no point we had to actually worry about the well-posedness of the variational principle.
But then our definition of symmetry is just, instead of saying that the equation of motion remain the same, or our definition of symmetry is the change in Lagrangian is a total derivative then.
Yes.
But that's not a physical definition, right? Means by the reason we assume that this is a definition of symmetry is because then our equation of motion remains same, and that would happen only if your variational principle is well defined.
Yes, but if you want, the form of the equations of motion of what you identify here is in any case independent of the variational principle that you choose. It's just a proper way to access this evolution equation. But you see, the way that we identified the Noether current yesterday was just by looking at this quantity here, plugging a symmetry transformation here, and asking if it is a boundary term or not. Since the equations of motion are always the same, no matter what you choose as variational principle, if this happens, if this variation is a symmetry, then see that this is independent of the boundary conditions that you have chosen. This will always be the case.
My confusion was only that when equation of motion always remains same, means they will hold only if the variational principle is well defined. Otherwise, we cannot say that equation of motions hold, right, on shell or something like that. But I agree, the form of equation of motion does not change whatever variation, whether we have the boundary term extra or not. But for us to conclude that equation of motions hold, we need the variational principle to be well defined.
Yes, but so you agree that here we could just add a, so if the worry is that to write this, I have to make sure that we have a well-defined variational principle, here I could just add an asterisk and say with a variational principle. Right? You could add this and then...
So that would just impose some condition on what b mu can depend on. That's what I was getting.
Yes, it could. It could. Right. But the point was that you can do this construction without having actually to worry about what these restrictions would be. It's a bit more general than...
Okay. Thanks.
Now let's just discuss a slightly more subtle example, which is not the scalar field, but Maxwell theory. So what happens if you want to build the energy momentum tensor in Maxwell theory? So in Maxwell theory, again, these are not gauge symmetries for the moment. These are just global changes of the coordinates here. So this epsilon does not depend on space-time. So for global symmetry, we have, so the question is how this thing here is acting on the gauge field. So this thing is acting on the gauge field in the following way. So this is a Maxwell gauge field, for example, the U1 connection, A mu. So this is acting. So usually if we do an arbitrary change of coordinates on a connection one form like this, this would act by the Lie derivative. But if this is just a global transformation, not an arbitrary vector field, the term in the Lie derivative which has derivatives of the epsilon will not appear. So this is just simply the directional derivative. This is just given by that. So you could check that this is indeed a symmetry of the Maxwell Lagrangian. But there's kind of a subtlety here, which is that if now you go ahead, use this symmetry transformation of the Maxwell Lagrangian, compute the energy momentum tensor which follows from this, you will find that this energy momentum tensor is not gauge invariant. The reason is that this transformation itself is already not gauge invariant. You see that if you perform a U1 gauge transformation of this field, this is not left invariant by this U1 gauge transformation. And because of this, so there is this, you may be familiar with this discussion in the literature of this notion of improved energy momentum tensor. This improvement of the energy momentum tensor is essentially a way to exploiting this ambiguity here to redefine an energy momentum tensor which has better properties. For example, the property of being gauge invariant. One way to do that in Maxwell theory is to actually, instead of considering this transformation here, you could consider what is called an improved transformation, which is obtained by combining this coordinate transformation with a U1 gauge transformation. Let's see what this looks like. So if we combine this with the proper signs, so the improved transformation delta epsilon is defined like this. A mu minus d mu of epsilon alpha d alpha. So you see that this is the form of a typical U1 gauge transformation of the gauge field A. And if you work this out a bit, you will find that this is equal to, I think there's a minus sign, yes, the field strength F mu nu epsilon nu. Okay, so now this transformation is gauge invariant because it involves the field strength. Now you can go ahead, compute actually the action of this on the Lagrangian. If you compute the action of this on the Lagrangian, so the Lagrangian, I remind you, is F mu nu. I dropped the factors of minus 1/4 that we typically put here. But if you compute this, the details are in the notes, you will find that this is, as expected, this is a symmetry. So the transformation of the Lagrangian gives a boundary term. The boundary term is epsilon mu times the Lagrangian itself. And now if you compute the Noether current associated to this symmetry transformation, again using the recipe which is here on the left, you will find that this Noether current is given by this. So 4f mu rho f mu rho minus delta mu nu f squared epsilon nu. So this has this structure as expected, and from this structure you read the energy momentum or the stress energy tensor of Maxwell theory. And you can check that this tensor is traceless, is gauge invariant, it only involves the field strength, and it's also conserved on shell. And on-shell conservation is guaranteed by the fact that we built this energy momentum tensor from the first theorem. And of course, one application of this, as you may know also, is that if you consider this epsilon now to be time translation, so far, epsilon mu, which is one, which is this vector. We can build can build a current which I called P in the nodes. If you build this object P, D3X, and this mu zero component of the stress energy tensor, and we picked the zero component because we used this symmetry parameter. So this is a conserved current. This is one candidate for J. That's a conserved current. But the conserved charge that you get from this conserved current is, again, because of what we said here, it's the time component of this current. So the time component of the current, which is already integrated here, is the conserved charge. And in this case, the conserved charge, if you work this out with this expression for the stress energy tensor, again, all the details are here. If you work this out, you find the Hamiltonian of Maxwell theory. Right? So as you expect, you find that the conserved quantity associated to time translation symmetry, using this, this improved transformation, is given by the energy, or the Hamiltonian. And what you would find here is that P0, so with the proper, okay, there are some numerical factors. Due to my conventions, D3x, E squared plus B squared. So the Hamiltonian. Okay. So now, see, this is not very satisfactory, in fact, because we had to kind of argue that you should not just look at the rigid translations, but you have to actually look at these improved transformations. So it's not really clear what the rules of the game are. It seems that we are by hand a bit messing with the symmetries and doing something which it's not actually clear where we're going. So there is a way out of this, a very clever way out of this, which is a systematic way of constructing a conserved energy momentum tensor. And this systematic way of constructing a conserved energy momentum tensor is by actually coupling the theory to gravity and then resorting to the principle of general covariance, so diffeomorphism invariance. So let's see what happens if we take any matter theory, any matter Lagrangian, couple it to a gravitational field. So by writing the theory, first of all, in arbitrary coordinates, and then putting the proper measure to integrate the Lagrangian to get an action, and also replacing all the partial derivatives by covariant derivatives. We do this, we couple the theory to gravity, and we see how we can build a conserved energy momentum tensor from this. So let's see how this works. Okay, so let us couple a matter theory to gravity. So by this, what I mean is that we take a Lagrangian now, which is the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian for general relativity. So this depends only on the metric. And then we add a matter Lagrangian, which depends on some matter fields. Let's just call them phi. And the metric. Okay. So just to keep track of all the factors to do this properly, see C4 over 8 pi j, square root of gr. That's the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian for general relativity. And this is the matter Lagrangian, which stays unspecified. Now, the energy momentum tensor is defined as, so there is actually a definition of the energy momentum tensor, but we will see what this definition actually entails in a few minutes. So the definition is the following. It's T mu nu. There are again some important factors, minus 2 square root g. The variation of the matter Lagrangian divided by variation with respect to the upstairs metric. Sorry. Okay. So if you compute the T mu nu with upstairs indices, this becomes a plus sign. And with this definition, when you vary this Lagrangian, what you get is the usual Einstein equation of general relativity, because this gives you the geometrical piece, and this gives you the energy momentum tensor. So we get the equation of motion is g mu nu equals 8 pi g over c4 t mu nu. So the Einstein equations. But again, the point here is not to jump all of a sudden to general relativity. We're not actually interested about really the dynamics of the gravitational field. We're just interested here in a trick, if you want, to actually derive a conserved, to derive a conserved energy momentum tensor. And the statement is that this quantity here, without specifying what L is actually a conserved energy momentum tensor. And to show this, we have to use diffeomorphism invariants of this Lagrangian, which is here. So diffeomorphism invariance, or which we also call general covariance, is the statement that this theory which we are studying here should be completely independent of the choice of coordinates. So to see what happens, to see what general covariance gives us, we have to use just a few formulas. So the first one is to recall that we have this. You take any scalar f, you compute the variation of square root of g times this scalar f. Well, the variation of the square root of the determinant is 1 half square root g mu nu delta g mu nu f plus square root g delta f. Now from this, you would get immediately that if this variation now is a Lie derivative, again, the Lie derivative is just the infinitesimal version of the change of coordinates of a diffeomorphism, you would get that the Lie derivative of this quantity. So by the way, I'm putting an arbitrary f here because this is the general form of a Lagrangian, of the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, or of any matter Lagrangian. Any Lagrangian would be of this form. There is some volume element here used for integration, and then there is some scalar quantity here. So the statement is that if you have a Lagrangian built like this, whenever you hit on this Lagrangian with a Lie derivative using this formula, you replace the Lie derivative in here. Here you replace this by the Lie derivative of just the scalar, and you will find that this, after a few steps, this is the divergence square root of gf. Okay? So this means that if you build a Lagrangian like this, the Lie derivative acting on this Lagrangian is a symmetry of the theory. Right? This is exactly the requirement that we had before to say that we have a symmetry of a field theory. So here it's a field theory which is very general because it's any matter field coupled to gravity. If you have such a field theory, you have invariance under this action of the Lie derivative because of this equality, which in turn follows from this. Now what this implies, so now how do we use this? These are just identities or formulas. How do we apply this to extract physics? Well, to extract physics from this, we compute the following thing. We compute the Lie derivative of the matter Lagrangian. Again, the matter Lagrangian has two contributions. There is a contribution from the field itself, scalar field, Maxwell field, anything you want, and from the gravitational field. So the Lie derivative of this matter Lagrangian has two contributions. The first one is this one, of phi. The second one is variation with respect to the metric. The derivative of the metric. And then again, to isolate these equations of motion here and here, we had to do the same manipulation as we did already twice. And this isolates here the symplectic potential, which we don't care about what it is, but the symplectic potential appears here. And because we have evaluated all these variations here on the Lie derivative, well, we have Lie derivatives also in here. So this is the potential evaluated on the Lie derivative. That's the boundary term, which is here. Okay. So now we're not going to manipulate this term. We're not going to manipulate this term. We're just going to manipulate what's here. And the way to manipulate this is just to say what is the Lie derivative acting on the metric. And if you manipulate this a bit, the divergence of the stress tensor will actually appear. So the first term, nothing happens. For the second term, we get a factor of 2, delta Lm by delta G mu nu upstairs. And the Lie derivative acting on the metric gives this. Well, it gives this symmetrized, but because it's contracted with G mu nu, we get twice this this term. Plus D mu theta mu on the Lie derivative. And now this term, conveniently, is actually the stress energy tensor. The sign should be yes, sorry, because this is G mu nu downstairs. Sorry. This should be G mu nu downstairs. So the variation is with G mu nu downstairs. So as we said earlier, if the variation is with G mu nu downstairs, you get T mu nu upstairs here, and you get a plus sign. So what you get from this is 2 square root G, sorry, below, plus. So the square root 2 goes in the definition of the energy momentum tensor. We get out square root of G, and here we get T mu nu nabla mu xi nu plus d mu theta mu. Okay, we get this from the definition of the energy momentum tensor. And now we can just integrate by parts on this covariant derivative, which is here. When we integrate by parts, we produce a boundary term, which will go with theta here. And we also produce the divergence of the stress tensor. Okay, so this doesn't move. Now we get square root g, divergence of t mu nu, xi nu, plus d mu theta mu, plus square root g, t mu nu, xi nu. That's what we get by integrating by parts here. And now we can conclude. The conclusion is that because this matter Lagrangian also has this symmetry here, for this to be equal to a boundary term like that, on shell of the equations of motion of the matter field, so remember here this is the equation of motion of the matter field, this means that on shell of the equations of motion of the matter field, this quantity has to vanish. So the stress energy tensor has to be conserved. And this just follows from this requirement of general covariance, or diffeomorphism invariance, or invariance under arbitrary change of the coordinates, which we have chosen to write this matter Lagrangian, coupled to any arbitrary gravitational field. Okay? This means that general covariance implies this has to be zero on shell. So the energy momentum tensor has to be conserved. Yes?
We're using covariant derivatives, but it's just kind of odd that we're not doing the same thing with beta zero.
It's not odd because regardless of the fact that it's, of course, you're right, this is an arbitrary set of coordinates, and there is a gravitational field. But at the end of the day, it's a field theory. And I insisted on writing it like this because no matter what you do, the field theory has to see the structure that we wrote earlier for the field theory, the variation of the Lagrangian, is always of this form. And that's also true in general relativity. The reason why there is no covariant derivative here is actually because I have absorbed the volume element, square root of g, in the definition of theta. What you could do, you're right, you could manage to have a covariant derivative here, but at the expense of pulling out square root of g, right? Yes, yes. So from here, you could use this, right? Of course, as you say, you could. Right. So what I'm writing here is actually this. So you could trade this for square root g. So you could trade it for that. And that's completely fine. But on purpose, I didn't want to write that. I wanted to write this because it makes it more kind of clear that it's just a field theory, right? Even though, of course, it's general relativity, but. So, and of course, if you do this, you have to be a bit careful because you see, it depends kind of what you're defining as theta, actually. So what, in the notes, what I took as a definition of theta, I think it's more common to do it like this, actually contains square root of g. But sometimes you will find this written like this. If you write it like that, you have to be careful about how theta is defined. Okay.
Mark.
Yes?
So also something like this is happening when we are doing partial, when we are doing integration by parts on a covariant derivative, but clubbing it with a partial derivative. In principle, the boundary term should be a covariant, but something like this is happening there also?
No, no, this is good. This is why there is square root of g inside here.
Oh, okay, okay.
There is square root of g inside here precisely because there is a partial derivative outside here.
Okay.
And
yeah, that's right.
Okay, so that's one way to get a conserved energy momentum tensor. In a minute, what we will see what we actually do with these conserved energy momentum tensors a bit later. Yeah, there's a question.
Mark?
Yes?
I wanted to ask a question. So in this case, we constructed an energy momentum tensor that is conserved because of general covariance. But in GR, this also follows from the fact that the Bianchi identities are satisfied. So how is, mm-hmm. I mean, in general, we don't have Bianchi identities because on the right-hand side, we can't guarantee that what is written on the right-hand side is conserved.
Yes.
So how does this definition of energy momentum tensor relate to something physical, which I really want to associate with an energy tensor?
Well, in fact, you're right. And all these things are actually working hand in hand, in fact. Here, as you know, Bianchi identity actually follows from general covariance. So if you are in general relativity, the Bianchi identity is actually the consequence of general covariance. In fact, we will derive this probably tomorrow. The Bianchi identity is a neuter identity coming from the second theorem associated to general covariance, to invariance under change of diffeomorphisms. So here, in fact, you saw in this proof, in fact, we didn't have to actually use the Bianchi identity. In fact, we know already, as you point out, from this equation here, if you have the Einstein equations, you know from this that because of the Bianchi identity here, T mu nu is conserved. But you actually don't have to use this. You can even be agnostic about this formula. You would still have this structure, which is here, this proof, and this will give you automatically that T mu nu is conserved.
Okay, thank you.
But now, so the transition here was to actually show precisely what happens for gravity. So we just said that you can build this for any field theory. And again, in the beginning, this started as a trick, and the trick was to take a field theory in Minkowski spacetime, for example, Maxwell or the scalar field. Then one way to get a conserved T mu nu is to actually couple the theory in a minimal way to a gravitational field, do this construction, and then at the end of the day, you can take g mu nu to be the flat Minkowski metric again. And you would get, if you do that, you would get exactly the t mu nu here of Maxwell theory or of the scalar field or of the whatever field theory you started with. So this is a way to kind of disguise the field theory in a general covariant manner and show that the t mu nu constructed like this is conserved. Yes?
Yeah, in fact, maybe I wanted to emphasize again that the construction on the right doesn't need actual coupling to the Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done independently of the coupling to gravity. In that sense, you don't.
Yes.
Yeah, but
yes, thanks.
Yeah. And in fact, if you do it for gravity itself, what you find are being.
Right, but I guess my question was then, because in GR, simply from the Bianchi identity, I know that the energy momentum tensor is conserved, but this is also the energy momentum tensor that is physical. So I know somehow it either describes a perfect fluid or something. But here I just construct an object which is conserved on shell or satisfies this conservation equation. How do I make sure that this object has any physical meaning? Or I can really associate the matter to it and that's conserved in some sense that I.
I think it's maybe the word physical meaning that is subtle here. In fact, but any, you see, the proof was just that any team you knew you construct in this way is going to be conserved. So you can build conserved quantities with any object constructed in this way. And that's, for the moment, all the only thing we wanted to do. And now, in fact, as Aldo nicely pointed out, of course, this is not independent of the actual coupling to general relativity here, to gravity. So this doesn't have to be G mu nu. So this doesn't have to actually give you the Bianchi identity. But the reason why I wrote this is that if now you actually, now imagine that's a bit where we're going. We want to construct conserved quantities for general relativity. We just said that you take any field theory by using this prescription here, you get an energy momentum tensor, which is conserved. So let's see if we take the field theory to be general relativity with matter itself. What happens if we apply this now to this Lagrangian, right? To the full Lagrangian, see what is the conserved energy momentum tensor that we get when we apply this to this. And if we do that, you will see that we get something trivial because we get the Einstein equations. So we get something which is identically vanishing on shell. So for gravity, we have a problem. The problem is that if we compute this, so now it's a T mu nu. Now I have different T mu nu, so I give it a specific name. It's the T mu nu for this Lagrangian now. So Einstein-Hilbert, gravity, plus the matter field. So I just apply this definition to the full Lagrangian. But if I do this, well, the variation of this with respect to the metric gives me whatever geometric contribution to the Einstein equation. In this case, it's the Einstein tensor. And the variation of this, by our definition, gives us the energy momentum tensor of matter. So what you get from this is actually the Einstein equation. OK? So from this, if you compute this, so you, now we take the full Lagrangian, delta L by delta, G mu nu, well, you get from the matter contribution here, you get T mu nu. And from the gravity contribution, you get C4 over 8 pi G, G mu nu. So you get something which is identically vanishing on shell because this is just the Einstein equation. So it's kind of a problem in the sense that we cannot use this prescription to build a conserved stress energy tensor, energy momentum tensor, for general relativity coupled to a matter field, or just pure general relativity. So we have to understand actually what is happening here and how we can actually meaningfully construct conserved quantities in general relativity. So that's what we want to understand now. So to do that, so of course you may already know, and we will see this tomorrow and on Friday, that kind of this problem, as it seems, which is happening with general relativity, is actually deeply related to the fact that general relativity is a gauge theory, and it's a gauge theory for some very specific gauge structure, namely invariance under arbitrary changes of coordinates. So diffeomorphism invariance or general covariance, which is the symmetry that we have used here. And because of this, it means that to actually meaningfully construct conserved quantities in general relativity, we have to understand properly this gauge structure of general relativity. So the role of diffeomorphism invariants, the role of these gauge transformations within general relativity. So to do that, of course, that's why we have to go to part section 3, which is now gauge theories or gauge field theories. But before doing that, we have to do something else. It would be a bit unfair if we jumped immediately to that without discussing another way of building conserved quantities in general relativity. Because as you may know, there are actually many very important and interesting conserved quantities in general relativity, which you can build and actually use without having to understand the gauge structure of general relativity, without even needing the Noether second theorem, which we will see tomorrow, without worrying about any of this. So to explain that, we have section 2.3 now, which is a first look at GR. So a first look at GR. It would be unfair to continue without talking about this because it would give the impression that the only meaningful way to talk about conserved quantities in general relativity is by just using the fact that general relativity is a gauge theory and using the second theorem. And that's not true. So to understand that, let's just remember geodesic motion in general relativity. So it's important to remember that general relativity is not only the Einstein equation, it's not only the equation which was here, it's this plus kind of a postulate, which is the fact that massive particles go on time-like geodesics and massless particles go on null geodesics. This is what tells you how objects, point particles move in a gravitational field. So it's an extra equation that you need to add to the theory. That's how you compute trajectories in Schwarzschild spacetime, for example. So the geodesic equation has this form. So for, let's consider an affine geodesic. I called it x sigma. We could call it x of tau. We could take the affine parameter. We could take the proper time for a time-like geodesic. As you know, if it's a massless particle on a null geodesic, there is no notion of proper time, but you could always define the parameter such that the geodesic is affinely parametrized. An affine geodesic just means that this trajectory here in space-time satisfies this equation, x double dot mu plus Christoffel gamma mu alpha beta x dot alpha x dot beta is equal to 0. So that's the geodesic equation. Why I rewrite this is that you can actually rewrite this geodesic equation in a way which is very suggestive from the point of view of what we said earlier. You can actually rewrite this. This is completely equivalent to writing the following thing. You can write d by d sigma, so the parameter of the geodesic, the metric g mu nu x dot nu equals, I think there's a 1/2, yes. 1/2 partial derivative alpha beta x dot alpha x dot beta. This is completely equivalent rewriting of the geodesic equation for an affine parameter. But this rewriting makes it explicit now that there is actually something that happens in some particular cases. So if the metric has some sets of symmetries, because you see from just this partial derivative of the metric here, this tells you that if the metric is such that it is invariant along a certain direction. So if d mu for some coordinate mu of the metric is equal to 0, you get 0. And so you get immediately that this quantity is conserved along the geodesic. So this is structurally a bit the same thing as what we said, the first remark we made yesterday about symmetries, conserved quantities from cyclic coordinates in the Euler-Lagrange equations. This is the same thing. And the reason is that these are just equations of motion. These are Euler-Lagrange equations for a variational principle, which is the extremization of the line element of the particle. And so just rewriting it like this, you see that you can get a conserved quantity. So the result is actually more general than this. So this was just to motivate. Now let's just write the general result. The result is the following. Is that if you write so the result is the following. Consider a conformal killing vector field. Conformal means that the vector field satisfies this killing equation. I call it K now, and not Xi, because it's really a killing vector field. So this would be zero if this was a killing vector field. But conformal killing vector field means that this can be actually equal to the metric up to some conformal rescaling here. This can be a function of space-time. If this is actually constant, we call this a homothetic vector field, if omega is constant. If omega is vanishing, this K is a true killing vector field. So the point is that if you have this now, so the first thing is that you take a killing vector field which satisfies this conformal killing equation. Now the other thing is you consider a quantity Q, which is this conformal killing vector contracted with the velocity of the geodesic. And the reason why I call this Q is that we can show a conservation property for this quantity Q along the geodesic motion. So for a geodesic, what you have is that d sigma of x dot mu, so that's the velocity of the geodesic. Being geodesic means by definition that the velocity is parallelly transported to the path. So this covariant derivative along the parameter, the definition of this is x alpha partial derivative. This is vanishing. This is the definition of having a geodesic. So the statement is that if x is a geodesic, it satisfies this. Now if x is a geodesic and k is a conformal killing vector, this thing is conserved in some situations. So you take these three things, and then you can show, again, the details are in the notes. You can show that q dot, so the evolution of this q in this parameter sigma along the geodesic, q dot is actually equal to, after some steps, you find omega g mu nu x dot mu x dot mu. So this is zero if omega equals zero or geodesic is null. So you find that q dot is equal to this. So this is vanishing in, there are two possibilities, either omega is zero. This means that the vector is a true killing vector. So this means that if you have a killing vector, so again, a symmetry of the metric in some direction, probed by this killing vector, then this quantity is conserved in the geodesic motion. You get a conserved quantity from a symmetry. So it's exactly the first theorem. But it's a bit more general. That's why I use the conformal killing vector, because if the killing vector is conformal, even if omega depends on space-time, you get actually this. So this is also vanishing if the geodesic is null, because you have the g mu nu x dot mu x dot mu. So if this is vanishing, you also get a conserved quantity. And as you may know, these conserved quantities, they are very useful because we can use them, maybe you have used them, to solve, for example, for the motion of particles, massive or massless particles, in the Schwarzschild spacetime. Because the Schwarzschild spacetime, if we write the standard form of the Schwarzschild metric, it does not explicitly depend on time, nor on the angular coordinate. So if we use t, r, theta, phi coordinates, the metric does not depend on t and phi. So because of this, you get two conserved quantities. One of them is essentially, asymptotically, would be the energy, and the other one would be the angular momentum. And from these two conserved quantities, you can actually reconstruct completely the motion of particles in the Schwarzschild spacetime without having to explicitly solve or use the geodesic equation. You just solve for the motion using the conserved quantities. So a bit like we did yesterday in the mechanical example with the, in the case of the conformal potential. Now just a remark. There are also some particular cases which I discuss in the notes, you can see, but that's the general idea of the construction. That's how, again, the only thing, the takeaway message is that from, again, as we were saying from the beginning, from symmetries you get conserved quantities. And this is, of course, true in general relativity without having to worry for the moment about the gauge structure of the theory. I wanted to make a remark about something. Maybe I say that very quickly because it's interesting. And maybe it's not so well known even to people working in GR. So there is actually a generalization of this construction here that applies to objects which are not Killing vectors, but what sometimes people call Killing tensors. So a Killing tensor is a bit, is an object which is a bit defined in an ambiguous way. There are two definitions for this. Let's see what these two definitions are and what this implies. So there are two notions. The first one is the notion of a Killing Stekel tensor. So this is a tensor K. Mu1, mu n. This is completely symmetric in the indices, which satisfies this. Satisfies partial covariant derivative k mu1 mu n is equal to 0. Okay. You can actually check that this implies that this mu1 mu n sorry, I hope you can read up there. It's a bit, a bit small maybe. Yeah, so it's a completely symmetric tensor of arbitrary rank, which just satisfies this equation. The completely symmetrized combination of all these indices is equal to zero. Then there is another notion, which is the notion of Killing-Yano tensor, which is slightly different. For a Killing-Yano tensor, you have that Y, let's call it Y now. Now the tensor is completely anti-symmetric. So you see, by the way, this why we take this definition of a Killing tensor? Because that's just a kind of a generalization to a higher rank object of the Killing equation. The Killing equation for a vector is just nabla alpha k mu is equal to zero, symmetrized. That's the one of the natural generalizations of this for a tensor. And you will see what this buys us, why this definition is interesting, because again, it leads to a conserved quantity. So that's one possible definition. Another possible definition of an interesting object is a Killing-Yano tensor. Now the tensor is completely anti-symmetric and satisfies this. Satisfies nabla alpha. You just symmetrize on the first two indices, mu n, and this is equal to zero. Well, you can show that if you have a tensor that satisfies either this or that, you can again build conserved quantities on geodesic motion. In this case, you can build a scalar conserved quantity. In this case, you can build a tensorial conserved quantity. Yes?
You introduced the notion of a conformal Killing vector field. Is mm-hmm. there any reason to not have such a generalization for tensors?
Yes, I think there are also conformal killing stackle tensors and conformal killing Yano tensors. But honestly, I don't know of any. I'm sure they have applications somewhere. I don't know. I couldn't give you an application of that. But as geometrical objects, they exist for sure.
So then the notion of the conformal killing vector field, you know, of rank one that we have here, you showed that, you know, you get this conserved quantity if this omega is zero, which means it's a killing vector. What's the use of this generalization in terms of conserved quantities? Is it just that it has this, I guess, extra boundary term?
You mean the use of these conserved quantities?
Yeah.
Well, there are some spacetimes which turn out to have these symmetries, and then you can get a conserved quantity from this. It's just a way of building conserved quantities in certain spacetimes. So usually we think that if the spacetime has really killing isometries, so really a true killing vector field, then you get conserved quantities. This was just to say that even if one day you have a metric, you have a spacetime, you know for whatever reason that it has conformal killing isometries that satisfy just this, well then you should be able to, just using this, to build conserved quantities. So that's a way in which you would solve the geodesic motion in this type of spacetime. To be honest, I don't know of, on top of my head, of an interesting example, but there are examples for sure, but they are just a bit. It's not Schwarzschild, for example. Schwarzschild is a true killing vector is enough. But the reason I mentioned this, which is a bit more fancy, is that this has an application in Kerr spacetime. This is very important in Kerr. So you will see why. Because if you have this, either of these two things, then you can build these two objects. You can build either Q, which is K. So just by analogy with this, you build Q, which is K, contracted with all these velocities, x dot mu n. This is conserved. Or you can build K, which has n minus 1 indices, n minus 1. And this is the contraction of y, mu 1, n minus 1, just with one velocity. Right. So either you have a killing Stekel tensor, and you build this conserved quantity, or you have a killing Yano tensor, and you build this tensorial conserved quantity. Then this is also conserved. And again, the proof comes just by taking this covariant derivative along the geodesic. You manipulate this a bit. You will see that this equation appears contracted with something which is completely symmetric, so it's vanishing. The details are in the text. Yes?
So in generalizing at the equation level, I see the generalization. But is there a generalization at like thinking of killing tensors as killing vectors where the Lie derivative of metric vanishes? Like that seems like to be a more symmetric definition of killing tensor, right? A killing vector. So is there a generalization at that level also for killing tensors? Like Lie derivative of some thing vanishes?
No, it's not this type of generalization, but still one motivation for using these two notions of tensor is that they satisfy very interesting algebraic properties. You can define a bracket on the space of killing Yano tensors. It has lots of interesting algebraic properties. If you're interested, I can send you references on this. There's also one kind of interesting property is that you can think of these killing Stekel tensors as being actually squares of killing Yano tensors. In some cases, you can show that, well, you can always show that you take a killing Yano tensor like this. If you have one, you contract all the indices in such a way that two of them are still free. Then what you get is, by construction, a killing Stekel tensor. So it satisfies this kind of interesting algebraic properties. So the reason I mentioned this now, to conclude with this and to move on, is that this has a very interesting application in the Kerr spacetime. Because in the Kerr spacetime, so as you may know, the geodesic motion in Kerr spacetime is also, in a sense, integrable. You have enough conserved quantities to actually completely build the evolution without having to worry too much about the geodesic equation, even though the evolution is, of course, much more complicated than in Schwarzschild. So in Schwarzschild, you have three conserved quantities. You have one conserved quantity coming from this construction associated with the fact that the metric does not depend on time. One is from the fact that the metric does not depend on phi. And in Schwarzschild, you have also another one because all the motions in Schwarzschild are actually planar motion. So if you start at some theta, you will actually stay in the plane of fixed theta. So in Schwarzschild, you get that the velocity, x theta dot, is actually vanishing. So because of this, you get another trivially conserved quantity. So you have three conserved quantities. And essentially, using these three conserved quantities, that's how you solve geodesic motion in Schwarzschild. In Kerr, it's not the case because the motion in Kerr is not planar. So you don't have this conservation equation here in Kerr. However, so you still have symmetries associated to this and to invariants under rotations along phi for Kerr. But you have a third conserved quantity, which is completely kind of not manifest from the metric, but which you can actually build. It's actually built in this way. And this conserved quantity is called the Carter constant, and it has the following structure. Well, maybe I don't give you all the details are in the notes. I don't want to write the Kerr metric because it will take me half an hour to write everything. But the point is just that for Kerr, there are two null vectors. L and k, so you have L squared is equal to 0 and k squared. And you also have LK. The vector is given in the notes, just to tell you the structure, what you need for this to work. You have these two null vectors, and you can build this thing. You can build K mu nu, which is rho squared L mu K nu plus A K mu plus R squared G mu nu. By the way, a trivial example of such a Killing-Stackel tensor is the metric itself. Right. The metric itself satisfies this because it's covariantly conserved. And also, if you contract x dot with the metric, you get an invariant, right? You get the line element. So the metric is an example of a Killing-Stackel tensor. So the statement is that in Kerr, this has an interesting application. In Kerr, you can exhibit two null vectors such that you build this quantity. Rho is... rho is rho squared in Kerr is r squared plus a2 cos squared theta, where a is related to the angular momentum of Kerr. Anyways, just using the data from the Kerr metric, you can build this quantity here from these two null vectors and from the metric, and you can actually check, better to check it with the computer than by hand, that this satisfies this Killing-Stackel condition. So it satisfies this condition. Therefore, you know that it leads to a conserved quantity. The conserved quantity following from this is called the Carter constant. And it's actually interesting that Carter found this constant by completely other means. And it's much later, actually a bit recently, I think that it was realized that this Carter constant actually descends from this this algebraic structure. So you get QC. Take this. X dot nu is the Carter constant of Kerr spacetime. Okay. So again, this was just to show that you can build conserved quantities in GR without having to worry about the gate structure. It comes from the properties of geodesic motion. And you can also build kind of generalizations of this using tensors, provided the tensor satisfies some properties. And this has actually very important physical applications. Okay, so now we can move a bit closer to the topic of interest and discuss energy in GR. So let's go here. So 2.4 gravitational energy. Sorry, you will see in the notes the kind of the plan is not the same because I'm skipping some sections here, so the numbering here is completely different than in the notes, so don't be confused by that. Okay, so the first remark is that given a symmetric conserved tensor T mu nu and a conformal Killing vector field. So you take once again one of these conformal Killing vectors, and now you exhibit somehow a symmetric tensor which is conserved. Well, if you have this, then you can build, so given this, you can build the following quantity. You can build J mu, which is T mu nu K nu, such that nabla mu of J mu, while the nabla will hit T, and you will get zero because T is conserved, then the nabla will hit K, but then T is symmetric, so you can symmetrize the contribution of nabla hitting on K, and you get the conformal Killing equation. So out of this, you get that this is omega times the trace of T. Okay. So this is zero if the trace is vanishing, or if omega is vanishing. So again, this is just a way to build a conserved current now from a symmetric conserved tensor. This can happen in two cases. Either the vector field is a true Killing vector, omega is zero, or if the vector field is a conformal Killing vector, then it's enough for the trace of T mu nu to vanish. And by the way, you see here again this relationship which always exists between conformal invariance and the vanishing of the trace of an energy momentum tensor. You see that here the vector field is conformal. If omega is non-vanishing, it's sufficient for the trace of T mu nu to vanish to get a conserved current. And again, if you have a conserved current like this, you can use the procedure that we wrote in the very beginning for field theory. You can integrate the time component of the conserved current. So here with the proper volume element, square root of g, to build a conserved charge. So now there is a particular case of conserved currents which are interesting, which are called Komar currents. So let's just introduce these Komar currents and see which property they satisfy. So the second point here, Komar currents. So of course you could observe now that we know such a conserved symmetric tensor in general relativity. It's just the Einstein tensor, right? The capital G mu nu, the Einstein tensor, satisfies the Bianchi identity. You can also check that if K is a Killing vector, then the Lie derivative of the Ricci scalar along K is zero. Right? Intuitively, this is because imagine you compute just a variation of the Ricci scalar. This depends on the metric only, so you get variations of the metric. Then you replace this variation by the Lie derivative. If K is Killing, you get zero. So this is vanishing. So because of this, this actually implies that, so these two facts together imply that any current of this form, R mu nu k nu plus some factor alpha, R k mu is conserved. So it's using these two things, actually. You see that in the particular case where alpha is minus 1/2, this is just the Einstein tensor contracted with k. Okay, and because of the Bianchi identity, and because of this, you get a conserved current. But also because you have this, the lead derivative of the Ricci itself along a Killing vector is vanishing, you can actually put any coefficient alpha that you want here. This will always be a conserved current. So now the Komar current is a particular representative in this family of conserved currents. It's the one for which alpha is equal to 0, in which you only put the Ricci here. So for alpha, and we will see what is particular about this Komar current. So for alpha equals 0, we get a candidate k nu. This is called the Komar current. So what is particular about this Komar current is that in this whole family of conserved currents, it's the only one which can actually be written as a divergence of something which is anti-symmetric. And we will see tomorrow why the connection with actually gauge symmetries, conserved quantities arising from gauge symmetries. So one can show that there is a bit of algebra involved. Again, all the details here. But you can show that by some manipulations. You can show that this J mu, which is defined in this way, R mu nu K nu, this is actually identically equal to Nabla nu. And here, oh no, sorry, you anti-symmetrize K nu, yes, like that. Yeah, it's a bit of work to show that, but it's kind of plausible because you have to use the fact that K is killing. If K is killing, you can actually trade this anti-symmetrization here for an anti-symmetrization here. So commutator of covariant derivatives is related to the Riemann tensor. And if there are some particular contractions, you actually get the Ricci tensor. So that's how you get the Ricci tensor out of this. So this is just an identity. This also makes it explicit. That you have this, that this current is conserved, right? It's explicit, you don't have to compute anything. It's just because of this anti-symmetrization here. When you compute this, you get that it's vanishing. So because of this, we could actually forget about everything we said here, about the fact that we use a Killing vector. See, you can actually get a conserved quantity, even if K is an arbitrary vector, even if K is not actually a Killing vector. You take any K, you take any vector, you just define this. You just define this as your current. This current is conserved. And the reason for this is that, so now it seems that we're saying that we can associate a conserved current to actually any vector field in general relativity. And that's a bit, it's the case actually. And the case is that in general relativity, you can consider any arbitrary vector field for any arbitrary spacetime as the generator of some symmetry, just as the generator of some change of coordinates. But of course, these changes of coordinates, they are gauge transformations. So to really understand the nature and the structure of these conserved quantities arising from gauge transformations, we have to wait a bit until until tomorrow. But okay, the point was just here to motivate that, again, there is this structure. We saw in field theory that if you have a conserved current, you can build a conserved charge by integrating the time component. Here we said that if you have a Killing vector, all the objects of this form are actually conserved currents. And then we just said that in this family of conserved currents, there is a preferred one, which is this one, because you can actually write it using this anti-symmetrized tensor, which is here. And you will see in a minute that, or tomorrow if you don't have time to conclude, that this actually appears in the definition of the energy.
Right.
So that's another reason for considering these Komar currents. Yes?
So you say that it becomes explicit, but we know that the covariant derivatives are not symmetric, right? So how is it explicit that del mu, j mu is zero? If the covariant derivatives were symmetric, then symmetric and anti-symmetric
Would become zero. Yes, so sorry, I should have been precise. To show this, you have to use that K is Killing here.
So if, but then you said that for any arbitrary K, it is conserved?
If I said that, that's a mistake. It's not, we can take this definition for an arbitrary vector, and this we'll see how this appears later in the when we discuss the gauge properties.
Yeah, but arbitrary vector, it will not be conserved. We can construct that current, but
it will not
be conserved.
Yes, for conservation, you have to use the fact that it's a Killing vector. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So let's just stick to Killing here. So should I stop or right? It's 10:30. Yes. So maybe I just say what we can continue with tomorrow. So to show the connection with this, now we leave this aside for just a few minutes. We do something else, and then it will reconnect with this. What I wanted to do now is just see what happens for weak gravitational fields, and actually consider so what we argued earlier in just in field theory, and we can check explicitly on Maxwell or on the scalar field, is that you get the energy by integrating the time component of some conserved current, and you can take this to be the stress energy tensor. And so to get the energy, you would essentially compute the 0,0 component, integral of the 0,0 component of the stress energy tensor. What I wanted to just do here briefly is to do this for general relativity. So make very crude assumptions. Assume that we have very weak gravitational fields. So everywhere the metric becomes the Minkowski metric plus a perturbation. The volume element here becomes just one, that of the Minkowski metric. And then just use the Einstein equations to write this on shell as C4 over 8 pi g, the integral of g, 0,0. So use the Einstein equations to write this as the integral of g0,0. Then compute g0,0 for weak fields, like we do when you look at the, for example, the Newtonian limit or the weak field limit of general relativity. And so that's what we will do tomorrow. But you will see tomorrow that even with these very crude assumptions, in the linearized theory and with weak gravitational fields, so linearized theory around Minkowski background, you will see that this g0,0 component is a total divergence. So this is a total divergence, so this whole thing here becomes a boundary term. So even, again, without talking about gauge symmetries for the moment, gauge transformations, and how this will lead to a definition of energy and angular momentum, just by importing what we have discovered before just in ordinary field theory, now we're just applying this blindly to general relativity. We take the stress tensor, trade this for the Einstein tensor, linearize this, this becomes the total derivative. So pointing at the fact that the energy is actually not a volume integral, it's a surface integral. So this is what we will do tomorrow. And then what we will show is that this surface integral, which we apply this to the Schwarzschild black hole, you will find the mass times c squared. So the energy is the mass for Schwarzschild space-time. We will also show that this definition is also the one that follows from this Komar current. If you take the Killing vector field in the Schwarzschild case to be the time translation Killing vector field, this definition of energy is the same one as the one arising from this conserved current here. In the case where you take this Komar current. So this was one of the reasons to introduce this this particular Komar current. So maybe we do this tomorrow, maybe. Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have a few more minutes for questions. And before we start with the questions, I want to say a bit what's the idea behind the next session. So after the coffee break, we will just meet with Mark on a more informal basis. It will not be recorded, so you feel free to have a discussion with him about course or something on, if that's where it takes you. It will be streamed on Zoom for the folks online, but it will not be recorded. And that's about it. So please, if you have any questions, go ahead. Thank you, Mark.